Welcome to the Terrible Podcast with your hosts from 970 ESPN and Steelers Nation Radio, David Todd, and from SteelersDepot.com, Dave Bryan. Just a couple of Daves chilling, talking Steelers. Now, here's Dave and Dave.
Welcome to the Terrible Podcast with Dave and Dave, Season 7, Episode 113. I'm Dave Bryan from SteelersDepot.com, and sitting in for the busy David Todd on this Monday is Alex Kozora. Alex, happy belated birthday, I think, first of all, and happy Monday.
Well, thank you, Dave. Yep, 24, right? That's I'm an old man now, right? Is that what I fall in that category?
Geez, when I was 24, I had already I'm trying to remember what I was doing when I was 24. I was out of the house at an early age, I think 14. So I already had a good 10 years of my life in at that time. I'm trying to remember and I can't. What I was doing at that stage of my life there. So, yeah, I didn't realize it until going through your Twitter feed this morning. And, we would like to apologize for the late start today with this thing getting underway and posted. Alex had some alarm clock issues this morning, but we'll forgive him being as how Sunday was his birthday and all. So, it looks like we have a semi-busy week on tap here, as related to the Pittsburgh Steelers. Their OTA sessions will get underway on Tuesday. It sounds like, getting closer and closer to having all these draft picks under contract. Joshua Dobbs, fourth-round quarterback out of Tennessee, signed his contract earlier on Monday, and that leaves just T.J. Watt and Cameron Sutton as the two unsigned players as of right now. That's subject to change by the time several of you listen to this podcast. There shouldn't be any issues with getting any all these guys under contract here in the near future. So, really talking point that we have is these OTA sessions. And Alex, I wrote an article a little bit earlier on Monday, kind of the five things that we could obviously build a list of probably 100 of these things to look for, but just the things that run, pressing on the forefront of my mind. We'll go over these five, and then I'll let you kind of add in some other things that maybe we'll hear about over the course of this, at least this first week, and then obviously right. More OTA sessions to come. First and foremost, who's healthy? Le'Veon Bell and Vince Williams, I think, at best, will both be limited during this first week of OTA practices and perhaps the whole thing, including mandatory minicamp. Le'Veon Bell, of course, is coming off that groin surgery, and there's absolutely no reason to do anything with him in these coming weeks, if you ask me. And Vince Williams, I think, is still recovering from off-season shoulder surgery. For the life of me, I don't think Tomlin has really let us know who else. We've heard Sammy Coates, possibly, had those fingers worked on early on in the off season. There, of course, is that, speculation that Martavis Bryant, something might be going on with the hip, but I almost wonder if Ed Bouchette might have just left out a question, maybe regarded as regarding somebody else in regards to Martavis Bryant. So it'd be interesting to see if Bryant is on the field for several reasons here at the start of OTAs. And additionally, I wrote about Gerald Hawkins and Cinquez Golson. One would think that both those guys, we'll be back participating. Both those guys missed the 2016 season with injuries and of course, subsequent surgeries there. Am I missing anybody that we should be concerned about health-wise?
I think that's a lot of them, Dave. Did Mike Mitchell have another procedure? I want to say he did this offseason. He probably did just anyway. He feels like he has a surgery every single offseason the way he plays. But I think Bryant's probably the number one name I'm circling, like you said, for a million reasons, just to see if he finally allowed to be back in the facility and getting back in the football. We know he's in Pittsburgh, but we haven't seen him in a Steelers uniform yet. If you weren't aware, Ed Bouchette, in I think last week's chat, had a response about Bryant and said, you know, there might be a concern about the hip, but that's all he said in his kind of very, let's call it, coy fashion. So we'll see what's going on there. But, you know, I think Hawkins will be available. I think Olsen will be available. Hawkins was photographed in Steelers.com in the phase two in some of the workouts. So he looked healthy and ready to go.
Yeah, and I think we've seen Sammy Coates doing some stuff as well. So, you know, and I think just before we went on the air, Ed Bouchette posted something on the Post-Gazette about, you know, a few things to kind of look forward to as well, too. And he mentioned, you know, that Martavis Bryant should be ready to go. So, once again, I don't know if that chat, it very well could have been somebody asking Ed about Keenan Lewis or something like that, you know, and maybe Ed just left that question out. But, you know, look, we'll be able to put this all to bed, hopefully, maybe, you know, by Tuesday at the earliest and by the end of the week at the latest. Martavis Bryant, for several reasons, and he's number two on my list. Will Martavis Bryant speak this week? He's obviously back in Pittsburgh. I think Bob Labriola recently noted, that he's around the team facility. Looks great. He looks ripped. Looks dreamy. I don't know. We enter in whatever adjective or description.
Looks dreamy.
You want in regard to that, Martavis Bryant, if those of you following along all off season, you know, he was out in Las Vegas working on his conditioning, apparently put on a little bit of weight, looked ripped as far as I'm concerned, you know, in these photographs. And I would expect, assuming he is allowed to speak to the media this week or at some point moving forward, Martavis will be asked about, you know, his year-long suspension, him being conditionally reinstated. And I would expect him also to be asked about, you know, the comments he made on social media following the Steelers selection of Juju Smith-Schuster as well too. So I think the sooner that he gets this first session with the media out of the way, takes all the questions regardless of how stupid or silly they might appear to be, the better.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Dave, and I hope that's the approach the team and Bryant takes, where you just, because the main focus here is to focus on football, because he's been away from the game so long, been away from his teammates for so long. You know, get this stuff out day one, then you go through the rest of OTAs, just focus on football with a clear mind and knowing those questions are generally behind you as you break, in the last offseason until camp starts up. So that's the hope for Bryant, is that he can just kind of tap this head on, say all the right things, people write their stories, and he can move on and focus on what's important, which is his family and football.
Yeah, and number three on my list, it's not a huge deal, but it'd be nice to hear Alejandro Villanueva speak. Assuming he's one of the ones chosen to do so or whatnot, you know, and especially considering that as of right now, it doesn't appear as Alejandro Villanueva has signed his exclusive rights tender. Now, he doesn't have much leverage right now, but whatever leverage he does have, it starts with him not signing that exclusive rights tender. But with that said, he can't play for anybody else. You know, he's he's property of the Steelers. But, you know, I've kind of speculated all offseason that, you know, they're going to get a deal done with Villanueva at some point. And I think now's the perfect time this offseason to do so, even though Villanueva doesn't have a lot of bargaining power. Until he signs that tender, he's not going to play. So it'll be interesting to see if he's asked about that, if there's any negotiations going on. And even if Villanueva does wind up signing a long-term extension, you know, between now and the start of the regular season, you know, I would think it'd be at a very, very fair value. We've spent a few podcasts, so far this offseason talking about that. Regardless, I wouldn't expect him to earn more than, say, Marcus Gilbert's earning on average, which is $6 million a season. But, you know, I think the two sides should be able to come to some sort of agreement where it's a fair deal for Alejandro Villanueva. It'll keep him, you know, in a Steelers uniform probably the rest of his NFL career. And if not, you know, give him an opportunity to strike one last time here as well. So, you know, that's number three on my list, is see what's going on with Villanueva and his contract.
Right, and I hope they get a deal done this offseason, because, you know, the longer you wait on Villanueva, the way his play is progressing, and if you assume that continues and he becomes you know, I think he might even be a top 10 left tackle right now, to be honest with you. Maybe that's me being a bit of a homer, but I think by the end of this year, he will definitely cement himself in that category and maybe even higher. And left tackles aren't cheap, you know, even though left tackle and right tackle on tape and on schematics aren't that different. They're facing marquee pass rushers. Left tackles still get paid a lot more than right tackles. So I think, you know, the quicker you can get this done, where his value is pretty good right now, but it's not going to be as high as it will be, the better for Pittsburgh to get a relatively cheap deal, which is what they ended up doing in hindsight with Marcus Gilbert. And I think Villanueva, of course, would want to be a Steeler. Where else would he want to go with a team that took the chance on him, you know, spent all the time and the energy converting him back to an offensive lineman to work with Mike Munchak? You know, Villanueva is taking classes at Carnegie Mellon. Does he want to go to, you know, Kansas City or Miami, you know, next year or wherever, and be far away and have to deal with that? I don't expect him to do that. So I agree. I think they will get a deal done, and I hope they do, because I think it's the best for all parties.
Yeah, and if they don't, he'll be a restricted free agent at the end of the 2017 season, and that limits what he can do anyway. So,
You're worried about other teams trying to come in and poach him. Remember what Dave T said? If we take that at face value, but other teams having a lot of interest in Villanueva?
Yeah, you just give him a high enough tender that it makes it, you know, where it's not worth teams to deal with that, you know. So I'm not worried about that. I think I think this gets done, and I think it's a deal fair for both sides. It just would be interesting to hear Villanueva talk about it potentially in these coming weeks. Not a big look. It's football in short season. Regardless, it's a time of season to you always hear that this time of year. Well, it's only football in short season. But hey, it's a reason to get excited as well. Which is it? I don't care. It's football to me. It gives us something else to talk about. And with that, you know, this time of year is always fun to hear, you know, about firsthand accounts of what kind of happens in these sessions, and especially when it comes to cornerbacks and potentially those covering Antonio Brown. You have two new young cornerbacks in Cameron Sutton and Brian Allen. You have a second-year guy in Artie Burns. You have a guy, hopefully, that'll be on the field in Cinquez Golson. You have a newcomer in Cody Sensabaugh. Not a lot to be gleaned overall, because you know, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, but it'd be fun to hear about a couple of these young guys potentially sticking with AB on a few of these plays, and, you know, maybe picking off one or two of them.
Yeah, I said it before, David. I'll probably repeat myself 100 times lead up to training camp, but just, you know, wide receiver versus cornerback is going to be the competition battles, you know, the position versus position to watch during training camp, because you have such a deep group of wide receiver, and you have all these young guys chomping at the bit at cornerback, trying to fight for starting spots, trying to fight for roster spots in general. So that's going to be really exciting. I'm just as interested, though, in where guys line up, and I probably put too much stock into it, because guys are going to move around a lot and they're going to see where people fit best. But I want to know who's the starting slot receiver and who's the starting slot cornerback, and where's Golson in the pecking order, and, you know, is Sutton playing inside and outside? Are they keeping him just one position? So I'm going to be trying to hunt for every little nugget of information I can about that kind of stuff.
Absolutely. And then number five on my list is, which of the young tight ends will step up? And once again, this is a beauty in the eye of the beholder thing. We're not going to glean too much of what happens over the next several weeks, I don't think, but maybe one will stick out a little bit more than the others. And, you know, Ladarius Green now gone. You would think that Jesse James, look, I mean, it's basically a repeat of where we were at the start of the 2016 season. And they didn't have Ladarius Green. That meant Jesse James was out there. It meant David Johnson was out there quite a bit as well, too. But you have guys like Xavier Grimble, you know. Do we really know who Xavier Grimble is at this point? Do we know what his ceiling is? I have a good idea that we do, but it's up to him, I think, to I don't think he's guaranteed anything at this point, even though Green was released. And then now, hey, you got two guys that a lot of people were talking about, in Fazan Odom and Scott Orndorff, two undrafted free agents. And, you know, we went through the 53-man roster prediction, both mine and yours, and you know, are they going to keep three tight ends and Roosevelt Nix? Are they going to keep four and Roosevelt Nix? Who knows at this point? But it would be good to start hearing a little bit of about, you know, who's doing what with these younger tight ends on the roster.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll be more interested in a guy like Odom once the pads come on in camp, because, you know, he's a 6'8", 250 guy. You know, he better look good in shorts. But, you know, we want to see that speed of the game coming from the FCS level at Fordham. Grimble, you know, I don't think we're going to really hear about it. And I assume he's much better in this regard than where he was last camp, but just his conditioning. Because I remember the first day of camp last year, and he had to bow out early because of conditioning issues. And I think it might happen again a couple days later. So, you know, I assume a year through the NFL and knowing what it takes, he'll be a lot better. But, you know, you expect a guy like Grimble to be a lot more conditioned than Odom or Orndorff, two guys that don't really know what it means to be in NFL shape and NFL conditioning. So, you know, Grimble better be a guy that is able to initially separate himself from those other people, because he's had the experience and he's been around the block and he knows what to expect. So, you know, if we hear a lot about Odom and Orndorff and not a lot about Grimble, not that it's a red flag, but, you know, it's something to pay attention to.
David and I obviously spent a lot of time talking about the cut of Ladarius Green and Greg Warren on the Friday podcast and all. And, you know, overall, Alex, I was surprised at the timing of it all, yes, mm-hmm. but in the grand scheme of things, if you would have told me that both were going to be cut by the start of training camp, I could have been sold that bill of goods that potentially could have happened. Warren is pretty cut and dry, I think. The probably the least surprising of the two, especially considering how the draft went. Where do you come in on this Ladarius Green thing?
Well, my stance, and I'm sure it was similar to yours and to most of Steelers Nation, was that, you know, I always said, you know, you hope for the best of Ladarius Green, but you can't trust this guy. That's where I thought the team was going to take a tight end. They showed some of those signs during the early stages of the draft process that they had a lot of interest in the position. Obviously, that didn't happen, but Green was a guy that you just take it year by year because you can't expect him to be in your long-term plans because of his injury history. Now, I think the interesting debate that you guys had on Friday's podcast was about what did the Steelers know before the draft? You know, did they know about Green's situation? And, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, Dave, you said you thought the team had a good idea about Green's, you know, situation, and David Todd said he didn't. Is that correct?
I believe that's how, I mean, and mine, of course, is all speculation.
Right.
The guy missed, he was injured week 15 against the Bengals. Mm-hmm. He didn't play again, not only the rest of the regular season, but all the playoffs. How long does it take for you not to know whether or not this guy is at least going to be a risk for you?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah. You might not have 100% confidence, but I mean, in my opinion, they had to know that there was a possibility that Green, I mean, was a lack of a better phrase, you know, a huge risk moving forward. I mean, you already have $6 million invested in him. Did something all of a sudden happen in, you know, in the weeks prior to the draft that you say, oh, okay, well, this happened, he regressed here, that you're saying, well, it just isn't going to work out? To me, I can't fathom how they didn't have any mm-hmm. inkling, you know, ahead of the draft that this might be potentially an issue. And look, I mean, part of my argument in that was, well, they didn't, you know, this isn't, I think I put it like this, this isn't fantasy football. You're not required to draft, you know, come out of the draft with a tight end. You know, maybe if a guy, the kid out of, who was the kid out of Toledo, they had,
Michael Roberts.
Right. You know, there was, you know, perceived interest there. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not going to draft one just to say, okay, we got one. We meet lineup requirements here.
yeah.
You know, maybe the one or two that they had their eye on and the value, you know, in the round that they thought maybe they could get You know, a guy like Leggett out of Clemson, my guy out of George Kittle out of Iowa, or Roberts out of Toledo. Maybe the board just didn't fall their way, and you know, they couldn't draft the position.
Right. I have two thoughts. One that agrees with your speculation that the team knew, and that was how I initially thought about it as well, because the team knew about Greg Warren, right? They drafted a long snapper for that purpose. So if they knew Warren's, you know, medical situation, then of course they would know about Green's situation if anything was happening before the draft. Although coaches, you know, Tomlin can't talk to Green, Green has to be able to communicate with the medical staff. I mean, there's no way that you just let Green go, and there's no way that that's allowed in the CBA. But this thought actually just hit me as we were talking about it. What if, and this would agree with David Todd's speculation, because we know Green went through phase two of the offseason. We saw the pictures on Steelers.com of him going through some of the drills, you know, relatively low intensity. But I guess you could theorize that he went through phase two and developed more symptoms after that. And the team realized that, you know, this is just going down a bad path, and they cut bait from there.
Yeah, but... Yeah, I can buy that after the fact. I guess my biggest issue with all this is just them not drafting a tight end in, say, round four.
Right. You know? Yeah, no, I'm with you. I'm with you.
That's my biggest question. And perhaps it's just related to the draft, you know, the board not falling their way and them not wanting to trade up to get X player. And, you know, I mean, like it or not, I don't think you – I guess you can make good arguments for reaching in some areas. And, you know, personally, I mean, I like the selection of James Conner. I thought he'd end up in Pittsburgh, but he was the only one in my mock draft I think I got right. But the fact remains, I was a bit surprised they took him in the third. You know, with that said, so, you know, are we ever going to get answers to these questions? Probably not. And, you know, therein lies, you know, the result. And that was them, you know, signing Scott Orndorff, a guy that kind of fits what they do immediately after the draft. And then, you know, Odom, of course, after the tryouts and that kind of thing. So, you know, I still have my questions there. I mean, you know, I think right now the tight end position has gone backwards. But let me not go down that wormhole just yet. We're talking about things we're looking for forward to in the upcoming OTAs. You've heard my five, so go ahead.
Right. Well, I was going to ask you, and I wrote about this right after, I think, you know, Green got released last Thursday. Is it fair for me to be frustrated with the way the Steelers have, I guess, vetted the medical of some of these guys, like Darius Green, of course, Brandon Boykin, who Carnell Lake admitted the doctors missed his chronic hip condition. We've seen Bud Dupree get rushed back, in his own words. He rushed himself and, you know, further injured himself and missed, you know, a good chunk of last year. I'm frustrated. Is that a fair way to feel, Dave?
I've never been one to go after them for rushing players back, because there's just too much unknown there. You know, now as far, I mean, we don't know what the player's telling them.
Right.
You know, I mean, if a player's not near 100% and you put him out on that field, well, then some, you know, questions obviously need to be asked. But I mean, look, I mean, let's face it, we don't know what goes behind the closed doors. Right. You know, player could be, you know, saying one thing. I mean, obviously if he looks fine in practice, I mean, that's a good gauge, I think, there. I think more of the frustration should be centered around, you know, what they did or did not know about Green and, you know, some of these other guys like Boykin ahead of signing him. You know?
Oh, yeah, I agree, yeah.
I mean, the thing with Green, it's not like anybody didn't know he had concussions in the past, you know, and you know, I don't know what, if anything was written or really known about Boykin and that hip prior to going out and dealing for him. But, I mean, it's frustrating with a guy like Green, for sure. Yeah. I mean, granted, I mean, look, I don't think you or I were doing jumping jacks after Green was signed, period, because of just, you know, we were in the mentality of traditional tight end sets and, a slot kind of guy like Green kind of just went against the grain, and I think that was the biggest issue. Look, he was not known as a great blocker, but I think they bought the bill of goods of what they thought Green was as a pass catcher. I mean, I think it's evident in the six games that he played in. This guy, when he was on the field, there was he was fine. It just goes back to, was it just one of those risks that they knowingly took as far as the concussion history went with Green? As far as the rest of the rushing players back, I tend to err on the side of the team when it comes to that, because obviously some of these guys you want on the field, you have early round draft picks and money tied up with and stuff like that. But let's go back to Lamar Woodley. I mean, did they rush Lamar Woodley back at any point once that initial hamstring happened? I mean, let's face it, even after they signed Lamar Woodley to that big deal, that looked like a great extension right off the bat. And then you had what happened in that game against New England, and you were never able to put the tires back on that thing after that.
Yeah, he's like that GIF you have with a car that wheels fall off. That's what it reminds me of.
And it's pronounced GIF. We finally got that. The guy who invented that took care of that. So
really? I didn't see that.
Yeah, there's an article. Several people have been making sure I see that. It is GIF with a J now. But look, we could probably dedicate a whole show to players we think may or may not have been rushed back from injury too soon. Yeah. I'm just not buying that narrative. So
right, I guess my comment was more about Green and Boykin, guys that seemed to be not vetted before they were signed or traded for. And if you believe, I don't know where you stand on it, Ed Bouchette's tweet about the Steelers not doing their homework on Green's concussion history, well then that's obviously super frustrating and a big area this team has to correct.
Well, I'll tell you this right now. I mean, that where there's smoke, there's fire, that thing going back to Green and the headaches. And I don't think I'll ever be sold on the fact that Green had to start the season on reserve PUP because of that ankle.
There's no way.
I mean,
that might have been part of it, but there could have definitely concussions played a factor,
or headaches, or whatever. Yeah. Tomlin can say what he wanted to say throughout that whole thing, Colbert as well. It just doesn't add up, especially now. Here we are, a little over a year after signing Green, and he's no longer part of the team. So it's the kind of thing that, all right, you made it. Here's the good thing, and we're all go to bat for Colbert. Is it's not often we're talking about failed higher dollar free agent signings. Mm-hmm. Now, on the flip side of that, an argument can be made, well, hell, Dave, what free agent signings, high dollar free agent signings does Kevin Colbert make anyway? And I guess if you looked at that way, at the percentage of guys that, two, three, four, five, obviously you have to take inflation into account here, over mm-hmm. the years, how many of these kind of things fail? Look, if you sign a guy for the minimum or a little bit of above the minimum and he doesn't work out, was it really a bad signing, thing? Now, you can definitely look at Ladarius Green and you can match it up to Sean Mahan, however you want, and order those guys number one, number two, however you seem fit. It was a bad signing. There's no doubt about it. The good news is it's not crushing this team from a salary cap perspective.
Right. And that's a great point. That's what I was going to say real quick too. In Colbert's favor, the way the Steelers structure these deals and the fact that they still don't spend huge money relative to the rest of the league, and to their credit, they've, quote unquote, fixed their salary cap situation to where they're in a much better place now than they were, say, 2 to 4 years ago, that they can absorb a blow like, Ladarius Green's dead cap hit for this year. So, There's one, I guess, small silver lining to this whole situation.
Yeah, but the fact remains, now you don't have a move tied in.
Oh, of course, yeah. It's a net loss, there's
right,
no doubt.
Right, exactly. Okay, now you've heard my top five things I'm looking forward to in OTAs. Anything you'd like to kind of add to it?
Well, you know, like I said earlier, I like to see where guys are lining up. You know, I want to know who's in the slot, who's kind of opening up there. You know, if Cam Sutton opens up in the slot to start OTAs, that might be the team was happy with his progression and ability to pick up the playbook and his ability to retain and learn. You know, it's Smith-Schuster. I want to know where he's at. I hope somebody can talk about where he's playing. You know, I know Todd Haley said they're generally going to start with them at one spot, see how they respond there, and if they can add something else, then they will, or they'll incorporate that later on in the process. So, you know, that's I'm still pretty, maybe I shouldn't be, but I still feel convinced that, you know, week one, Smith-Schuster is going to be the starting slot receiver. And I think the release of Green only adds to that a little bit more because, you know, in some ways, not always, Smith-Schuster can represent some of the things that Green's able to do as that bigger seam threat. So those are probably the rookies, of course, and just where those guys are lining up. I guess I could say the slot is where I'm focused on offensively and defensively.
Yeah, look, we have all this charted, and it wasn't like Ladarius Green played a ton of snaps, you know, in those six games. You know, how many times when the football was snapped was he detached from the line of scrimmage? You know?
Yeah, I forget the number. Matthew would have it. I'd have to go back and look.
You know, but, I mean, we can easily find out. I mean, it's not like, you know, we call Ladarius Green a tight end. You know, he did line up some at the end of the line of scrimmage. And, you know, when you roll those personnel packages out there, when you have a guy that you can do that with, you know, obviously it makes it a little bit tougher on defenses, but, you know, it's look, I mean, it would be something kind of new to us to see more for wide, you know, true wide receiver sets, but, you know, I don't think it's out of the question. I mean, look, they got some talented guys now, and they spent a second round draft pick on Juju, and, you know, barring him just, you know, not picking things up, you know, from an offensive perspective, they're going to get him on the field sooner or later. And, you know, assuming you have Martavis Bryant there, you're going to have him on the field as much as possible. You're going to have, obviously, Antonio Brown. You know, we'll see what happens with a guy like Eli Rogers and Sammy Coates. But, I mean, you can mix and match this thing a lot of different ways right now, even without having Ladarius Green.
Right, and that's what I said from almost the moment that Smith-Schuster was drafted, was that, you know, that's the only place where he has a real clear chance to play, and rookies don't sit anymore. You know, that ended with Stephon Tuitt, because what happened with Tuitt was there was frustration that Tuitt wasn't playing. He was behind Cam Thomas, even though Tuitt was clearly the better player, and LeBeau didn't want to play rookies. And so when Butler, you know, became the defensive coordinator, part of his charge was to simplify the scheme and make sure we get the rookies on the field right away. And it works both sides, offensively and defensively. And yeah, those guys just don't sit anymore. And I think, you know, with the attitude that Smith-Schuster's bringing and the traits that he has, I think he fits as a slot receiver, and they're going to want to try to, you know, find out what they have in him. So he's going to get on the field, I think, pretty quickly. But, you know, I wrote about this. People can say, well, Smith-Schuster is going to replace, you know, Green entirely. It's not entirely true, though, because if you bring in 12 personnel and flex Green out where you're facing the base defense, Smith-Schuster, if he comes in, they're facing nickel personnel. So defenses respond different ways to your personnel.
Absolutely. And here's the thing about Juju, at least on his college tape, is he's not afraid to block. And, well, you go back to all those times you hear Richard Mann talking about, you know, liking those wide receivers with the ability to dig out those safeties. And you know, look, we've seen the teams do it against the Steelers with and cause guys like Artie Burns last year to get in a little bit of trouble when not knowing when.
Don't remind me about that Miami game, dude.
You know, when to crack and replace, you know, that kind of thing. And, you know, assuming, you know, Juju's, both willing and has the ability to do more than just, you know, be a route runner. You can do a lot of things with him closer to the line of scrimmage. I mean, closer to the tackles.
Right. And in some ways, Smith-Schuster is able to replicate the things Green does as a blocker, being a mismatch with, you know, a 6'2", 210 guy in the slot is much different than Eli Rogers at 5'11", 190, whatever he weighs. So there is definitely some benefit. And maybe we'll see some four receiver sets. You know, I tweeted it out after Green's release that, you know, that's where your talent's at receiver. And so you want to get those guys on the field. And so you might see some different things there. But, you know, I think the caveat to that is what I mentioned, and I know you understand this. It's just about personnel groupings and how defenses respond. You know, you think of New England. You know, when they had Gronk and Bennett, they could go 12 personnel or even 22 personnel with their fullback James Devlin, and then they could go empty or they could go, you know, four wide and flex Gronk and Bennett out. And now you have to have your linebackers walk out, try to defend that. It lightens the box in the run game. I mean, there's so many extra benefits to the big move tight end, which is why, you know, I admit I was excited about Green when he signed and what he could bring to the table. And that's just something that, you know, it's no fault of, you know, Juju's, it's not his fault at all, but that's something that he's not going to be able to replicate.
Right. You're not implying that Juju's going to line up with his hand in the dirt.
No. Yeah, he's not. Definitely not. No, he might want to, though. I'm sure he's an eager guy. He probably wants to try it.
I mean, it's definitely going to be interesting to see how Todd Hale, you know, assuming all these guys stay healthy and assuming Martavis stays on the straight and narrow, and, you know, we can only hope. I mean, look, Sammy Coates right now, nothing's guaranteed for him right now, but if we get the same Sammy Coates that we saw those first four and a half games of the season, you know, that's fine. Now, do I think Sammy Coates is ever going to be a premier wide receiver in this league? Absolutely not. I think he's still got a lot to prove. And, you know, obviously we hope that we don't have to see a lot of him this year because of the Martavis being the guy to stretch things on the outside there. And, you know, look, say what you will about a guy like Darius Heyward-Bey. I'm more excited about Darius Heyward-Bey being a Steeler today than I was maybe initially when he was signed a few years ago. But at this point, you know, the only thing attaching Darius Heyward-Bey to this to potential roster spot, as we talked about recently, was the fact that this guy knows his business, his special teams guy, and, you know, he's a special teamer first and a wide receiver second.
Right. You know, I think that DHB is a guy that's obviously one of the best condition players. He's still that vertical threat. He's a great blocker. He's a strong teammate. The young guys go to him for advice and to watch tape and things like that. So, you know, this receiver group is so deep. I mean, there are 8-9 guys that, you know, have maybe either been on this field or have played in the NFL or just have the talent, you know, like a Smith-Schuster, that they're going to get an opportunity. Are we overlooking Justin Hunter, Dave? I know we get some comments on that from time to time, and I can understand it. I mean, he's a guy that, you know, is a big play receiver that has not ever been in a stable environment, and now he's going to, you know, be in one. Is it fair to say that, you know, we're overlooking him a little bit?
I think a few things just have to happen for him to get a roster spot. You know, I think a lot of them are tied to Martavis Bryant, quite honestly, right? Because, you know, and I've said this several times, there's just nothing in Justin Hunter's previous resume from a special teams standpoint that makes him attractive past him being a starter for you, you know, on the outside. So, I just think so many things have to happen, mostly related to Martavis Bryant and then potentially Sammy Coates. Because, like it or not, you know, say what you will about Sammy Coates and then a finger last year, he still was able to do a few things on special teams, you know, and that's just something that I have not seen on the film from Justin Hunter. So Justin Hunter better get himself acclimated to who Danny Smith is, and and, you know, whether it be as a gunner or what have you, know, just it's kind of limited for wide receiver roles in special teams if you're not one returning, you know, with a football in your hands. And I just, you know, I'm not going to rule it out. I'm not going to say absolutely guaranteed Justin Hunter doesn't make this 53-man roster. But if he does, you know, I think something strange like 7 need to be kept or something needs to happen. Maybe something go wrong with Martavis Bryant or, you know, injury somewhere else.
So let me ask you this, Dave, and this will be my last comment on the receiver situation. I know this is before the Green release. I had 7 receivers in my first 53-man roster prediction. Do you think there's a higher chance of that happening now post-Green release, or do you still think 6 is going to be the max?
Yeah, I think I'll be surprised. I mean, even if they would have – either way, I think I'll be surprised if we're sitting here talking about 7, you know.
Okay.
And that's even with saying that Darius Heyward-Bey's a special teamer first and then a wide receiver. I think you're better off using those numbers elsewhere, you know, in my opinion. I mean, I'll be shocked if it's 7. Look, I mean, there's no guarantee it'll be 6, you know, but I like the likelihood of 6 you know, a whole heck of a lot of more right. than I do seven. So
right.
You won't see me picking seven. I'll tell you that.
I'm going to keep banging that drum. I think it's got a good chance to happen, especially now post Green release, because you think about it, what you kept four tight ends last time, I kept three. Now you lose a tight end because Green's gone. You got a rush spot to play with now, Dave.
I'd much rather, and look, I even admitted keeping four tight ends plus Roosevelt Nix. I mean, that's probably unlikely going to happen. You know,
right. So where's that extra rusher spot going to go? You got LJ Fort. You know, you could throw a safety on there, I guess.
I'd carry an extra outside or inside linebacker, something like that. And that's where I ultimately think I think ends up happening with this group, to be quite honest with you. All right. Anything else you'd like, you're looking forward to in OTAs? Football and shorts.
Yeah, best time of the year. No, I think that's everything. You know, we'll get some little pieces out. You know, Tomlin's not going to say much. He's going to get asked about Green. I doubt he even tries to give any sort of response. No, I think we covered it well.
All right, now back to – we almost went down this wormhole a little bit earlier. Now let's slide down into it. And really, because I reached out to my Twitter followers this morning saying, if you have any questions, you know, shoot them at me. And it seems like instead of singling out one, it seems like a few of them are related to, you know, kind of the backup tight end position right now. A few, you know, related to Jesse James. You had a film room up Monday morning about Jesse James as well, too. What and who is Jesse James right now? And, you know, is there any reason to think that he's any more than what we've seen out of him already?
Well, you know, I think there's still some upside left. I don't think it's immensely high, but he's still, what, 22 years old, you know, and he's still, you know, figuring out the NFL. And last year was really his first full year and coming in and being the guy when you didn't think you were going to be the guy because the Green situation, you know, might have been a little bit of a shell shock to him. The upside to Jesse James, and this is what I wrote about today on Steelers Depot, is that, you know, Pittsburgh, maybe more than any other team in the NFL, still kind of looks for that old school usage and mentality with their tight ends. They want guys who are going to play in line, hand the dirt, 3-point stance, be physical blockers, you know, in the run game, do some pass protection, the number one tight end staying in the pass pro, especially against 4-3 defense, just like the Cincinnati Bengals. And I think James improved there a lot last year as the year went along. And obviously he has the frame to do that as a 6'7", 250 or whatever he is, tight end. So you know, that's the upside of Jesse James, is that he can do that inline stuff that, frankly, Ladarius Green was not brought in to do and really couldn't do as well. So I think that's one reason why they didn't take a tight end, because they had the confidence in James that he does what a Steelers tight end needs to do.
Now, here's the thing with Jesse James. He did grow as a blocker, I thought, last season, and it was very noticeable. It wasn't just like incremental. We saw him do some good things as a blocker, especially out on the edge. Heck, what was that long touchdown on? Was it against Miami?
Yep, the playoff game, the bubble to AB.
Right. You know, we saw him take care of essentially two people on that play. Mm-hmm. We've seen him do good stuff out on the edge. We've seen him do stuff as a move guy with split zone type stuff. We've also seen him have some whiffs still in that area as well, too. That's not the portion of the game where I'm worried about Jesse James. It's what else? It's using him as a receiver. And, you know, I don't think he's a guy that's going to strike the fear in opposing defenses as a guy that can stretch the field vertically and do some of the things that Ladarius Green did in a short amount of time, six games that he played.
Right, definitely not, and that's the big difference. Is he's not going to be the vertical threat. He's not going to be the seam, the guy down the seam to split, you know, cover two. But as a receiver, again, he's that old school guy. He can make tough catches in traffic. I think he got better with his football IQ and getting open in scramble drills and finding space in zone coverage. And he's got good hands. So, you know, he's very, you know, Heath Miller light in the sense of, so his skill set is obviously not as good, but it's similar to Heath in that Heath was never a vertical threat at all, but he was a guy that's going to make tough catches in traffic, which is a must for a tight end. He's going to be a physical blocker. He could pass pro with the best of them. And I think James can, you know, could obviously continue to improve on that and be a very Steelers tight end, you know.
And one other thing I wrote after the season ended that worried me the most about the 2016 season when it came to James is he was not an asset on third down on third downs last year. I mean, right. You know, you go back and look at what Heath Miller was a much better, more reliable third down option, move the chains kind of guy. And Jesse struggled in that last year. And I forget the targets and all like that. But, you know, he had some key drops and things related to that. And, you know maybe with Juju and you know, maybe when you get into these third and four, you know, six situations in 2017. Maybe you know, we're at a point now where they have the personnel where they don't need a guy like Jesse James on the field in those situations. But I think that was, you know, in addition to it being a positive with the way that his blocking improved in 2016, he didn't show me much of anything on third downs. And you know, I wrote extensively about that, you know, after the season ended. So, look, I don't hate the guy. I mean, I think he definitely has a spot in this offense. I think he's a guy that can play you, what, 600 snaps, 500 snaps?
He'll play a lot. I mean, he'll have to, I think.
Right, right. And, you know, maybe more than that. I mean, yeah. Look, I mean, he's going to be your guy. Barring them going out and going the free agent route, I mean, he's going to be the guy.
Yeah, I think he's going to play, like, I don't know, 900 snaps this year just because there aren't a lot of situations I see him coming off the field.
Right, and then we'll have to see how much David Johnson gets in as a number two, and if we'll continue to see things like Chris Hubbard is, you know, the number three, you know, or extra lineman, if you will, because we saw, you know, quite a bit of that as well too. So, you know, it all goes back to, you know, it'd be interesting now that Green, a guy that you were able to do a lot of different things with, how that's ultimately replaced now.
Yeah, right, and that's just so tough to do. I mean, again, a guy like Smith-Schuster can do some of that, but he's not going to replicate it entirely, again, how defenses respond to your personnel. But, people say about Green, you know, you can't miss what you don't have. I mean, I get that Green didn't play that much, but, man, when he played, he was an impact player. He had 7 explosive catches last year, 20-plus yards. That was tied for third on the team. I mean, obviously, Bryant's going to give you a high dosage of those as well, but not from the seam. And that seam threat, you know, when you have that seam threat, teams can't play too high against you. They can't play straight cover two. They can't, you know, two man's risky as well, because it opens up the seam. That's the weak spot. And so now, without that seam threat, teams can play cover two and they can roll safeties over the top of AB and Bryant or whoever you have there and play a lot more bracket coverage and make those windows a lot tighter. If you're playing, you know, if you have that seam threat, you can play, and defenses play single high or they're squeezing their safeties because of that seam threat, now it opens up, you know, AB and Bryant on the outside. So, while yes, Bryant could easily surpass what Green did in explosive plays last year, it's not always about just the number, but about where you get it from and what that causes a defense to do. And that's something that Brian can't do, and obviously Jesse James will not be able to come close to.
Alex, have I written enough both positively and negatively about Joshua Dobbs?
Oh, man. Yeah, it's funny how everyone quieted down when you were saying nice things about Josh Dobbs, though. But no, you've done some great studies looking at the touchdowns. I think Sean had a really in-depth article, too, looking at all his completions last year. So let me ask you, Dave, since you did all the legwork, I mean, how differently and in what ways do you feel differently about Dobbs now that you've gone through all this really good extensive research of him, you know, compared to when the team first drafted him?
Well, let me start off by saying, people say, well, why the heck are you writing so much about a guy that unlikely to see any playing time as a rookie, and who knows if he ever develops anything more than, you know, maybe a backup in the league. Look, if we don't have a starting point, a reference point with Joshua Dobbs, me, you, the listeners, whoever, then how the heck are we going to know if he ever makes any progress, you know, during the preseason? So I knew a little bit about Joshua Dobbs ahead of the draft. Knowing that now that he's going to get probably a lot of playing time during the preseason, I at least wanted a good starting point to say, oh, yeah, I saw him do that kind of stuff at Tennessee last year. He's been able to change this. He's been able to change that. These are some of the same things that he's doing. These aren't those types of things. So that, you know, for people wondering why the heck you spending so much time on Joshua Dobbs, well, A, people just don't realize how long this offseason is going to be after we get done with these OTAs and all. We're still going to have plenty of time to write about, you know, these other draft picks, and I've already started picking out some things to write about T.J. Watt and those kind of things. But I wanted to have, and I, you know, I wanted the readers and listeners to have a good starting point as to what kind of player he was during that final season coming out of Tennessee, so we can intelligently talk about what we see transpired during the preseason. And I hope and think I have done that now. Now, is there going to be probably any much more stuff about Joshua Dobbs moving forward into the offseason? No. We beat him up good and bad, good enough. Now, to your question, I am a lot more comfortable with Joshua Dobbs than I was ahead of the draft, quite honestly. And people think that I picked on Joshua Dobbs, especially early on. A lot of the studies that I did, I think, ended up turning in his favor. I mean, the guy, in my opinion, didn't have a lot of help from his wide receivers throughout the season. Now, people say, well, Dave, that's all relative. You could go through the other nine quarterbacks that were drafted this year, and you can cherry pick them and whatever down that you want and say, well, their completion percentage would have been better, you know, drops, blown assignments, what have you. Well, that wasn't my intention. My intention was to find out why the hell was that third down completion percentage so much lower for Dobbs than it was those nine other guys. And I think I uncovered that. Now, to the argument that you could cherry pick the rest of these quarterbacks as well, too, while I don't know for sure, and it's pure speculation on my point, I think you'd be hard pressed to go through those other nine quarterbacks and find as many drops, you know, on third down situations than Dobbs had. Now, I think you saw the charting that not only that I did, that boy Sean, really, you think I did some work? Look at the charting that Sean did with you know, completions and stuff like that, pass attempts. He can make all the throws.
Mm-hmm.
There are some accuracy issues, I think, beyond, 15 yards and all, that I think he needs to clean up. His touchdowns, as you would expect, are impressive. I mean, why wouldn't they be? They're highlight plays. But he did some good things, I thought, three or four of those were wide open receivers that had he missed those, they would have shown up in some of the negative, you know, incomplete stuff that we did. But I like, you know, what stuck out to me was his seemingly knowledge that he had of his own offense, his ability to get people look lined up in the wrong places into the right places. Sure, he did a lot of his work out of nearly all of his work out of the shotgun. That's going to be a challenge for him at the NFL level, is getting up underneath center. But it looked like he had a good grasp of not only what was happening on the offensive side of the ball, but what he was seeing across from him as well. There was some good pocket presence there. I mean, he stepping into the pocket, avoiding rushes, and moving up when he needed to deliver throws, those kind of things. For a guy that was taken in the fourth round, you know, I understand why he was their guy in short. Now, did I still like Dak Prescott's final year at Mississippi State more than what I like Dobbs? Yeah, but you know, I don't think I broke down Prescott as in depth as I have Dobbs at this point. So. I am a lot more comfortable with Joshua Dobbs than I was even on draft day.
Yeah, no, I think you did the study well, and you mentioned the struggles with receiver and the offensive line, which, you know, was a mess, as you pointed out, and kind of went through the combinations that they had, and Dobbs still had a successful season in spite of all that. And although you and I have talked about it endlessly, that we weren't crazy about the pick, and for us, I think it's really more about a position thing than it is Dobbs in particular, because you know, I want to make it clear. I like Dobbs' pick more than I would have liked him taking Brad Kaya, more than them if they would have taken Nate Peterman. I probably like the pick more than I like them taking Landry Jones, you know, several years ago. So, you know, I get the talent with Dobbs, and there is things to get excited about that. There's no question about it, and you went through it all really well, and Sean did an incredible study on it as well. But, you know, it's a position thing for me, and we'll see how he looks in camp, though. You know, we're going to eventually, you know, once camp starts up, I forget about my draft, you know, thoughts and, you know, positional value and all that, and I just look at how the guy plays. And if he can show snap-to-snap consistency, which I think is going to be the big issue for him, you know, not just – because, like you say, he's going to be able to make the corner route. He's going to be able to throw it down the seam. He's going to make some impressive plays in camp. There's no question to me about it. It's about that down-to-down consistency of, you know, do you throw the five-yard curl on time and in rhythm and with a good ball placement every single time? Do you throw the swing to Bell, you know, in stride every single time? That's what I care about with Josh Dobbs. That's what got Landry Jones in trouble, and that's what he improved on immensely to make him a backup quarterback in this league.
I think Dobbs can be a better quarterback than Landry Jones. Now, that's to some listening, they probably say, well, that's not much.
You
know?
Yeah,
but,
right.
You know, and really, it's all, you know, it's really the only kind of measuring stick I'm willing to go at this point to say that I think he can become a better quarterback than Jones, and perhaps quicker than Jones, you know, as well. So, you know, look, he stands in that pocket and takes some hits, and he did some good things at Tennessee. And, you know, trying to remember back what I remember going through and studying Landry Jones, you know, after that selection and all. So I guess we'll kind of leave it at there. I think he has a potential to be better than Landry Jones and probably quicker than make a, you know, more quicker progress than Jones as well, too. And where he goes from there, we'll see.
Right, yeah, and I agree with that assessment. I think he has the upside to be better than Landry Jones. You know, for me, it's not about just his talent. It's how does the team get him on the field so he can show that talent and progress. And that's the difficult part for me, knowing that this team is, you know, very likely to draft a quarterback high within the next 1 to 2 years, which could, you know, with Landry Jones still under contract, could make, you know, rising up the depth chart tougher for Josh Dobbs. But, you know, there's definitely reasons to get excited about him. I'm glad these rookies are obviously getting signed. That's pretty commonplace now, and that's one thing the CBA got right, is that these rookies get under contract almost always, you know, before training camp, as long as you're not Joey Bosa. And these guys can come in and not have to worry about that and start, you know, their football life right away.
And so, you know, to the listeners, I promise that's probably going to be the biggest extent of what you hear about Joshua Dobbs until the preseason gets underway, because we pretty much pick clean his 2016 tape. But I just thought, and look, it's an easy target being a quarterback, such a high profile position, and a little bit easier to pick out, you know, the plays and go through the play by play and match it up and all, than it is, you know, some of these other positions and all as well too. All right, we'll kind of end on this topic. NFL.com doesn't expect TJ Watt to be an early contributor. Matthew kind of recapped that article, I believe this morning. You disagree with it, and I think I do as well.
Yeah, I think he will be a contributor. I mean, I'm not going to say he's going to be an all-star, and he's not going to get 10 sacks. I mean, he might end this year with only 4 or so sacks, but, you know, I think they kind of, you know, downplayed him because they said he's an effort kind of pass rusher and stuff like that. Well, obviously, you want him to become more than that, and I think he has the skill set to do so. You know, being an effort guy is going to reward you well, you know, creating your own luck. And that's how Bud Dupree got some of his pressure, you know, his first year in the league as well. So, obviously, there's a playing time factor. He's going to play 50% of the snaps this year, because you just can't ride the wheels off Harrison too early. And that's just going to, you know, let him be able to make an impact. So I disagree with the notion that he's going to be, you know, very, you know, they call it a redshirt season for him. It's not going to be redshirt. He's going to end up playing probably 500 snaps this year, and he's going to get a chance to make some plays.
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, I'll be disappointed if he's not on the field that at least 50%. I mean, you know, 1,000 snaps is usually the barometer for how many snaps a defense plays during a season. If it is less than 50%, it damn sure better not be by much. I mean, you drafted this guy. I mean, look, right. I mean, you go back to what Art Rooney II said ahead of the draft. We got to do something different, get a pressure on opposing quarterbacks. And if you didn't go out and add a factor during free agency to do that, It's got to. Where else is it going to come from except the guy that you drafted? So yeah, I think pressure is going to be on the coaching staff to get him up and running as quick as possible and get him on the field initially, maybe 10 to 15 snaps a game, and then come after that bye week. God bless James Harrison, but. It's in my opinion, it probably has to be Harrison being the one to come in and spell T.J. Watt.
Yeah, it could be if Watt shows up well enough. And I think most of that's going to be just based off their own, Watt's own progression. But, we talked about it before. He's a lot more refined than where he should be for a guy that didn't play a lot of outside linebacker at Wisconsin. And he played in a 3-4 system. He's got experience with his hand up, dropping into coverage, rerouting the Y or the number two down the seam. He's got experience on stunts and, setting the edge and being the container, being the looper. So, he's got all those traits that tell me he's going to have an easier than average, still difficult, but easier than average learning curve to transition to the NFL, and the play time's there, and he's a talented guy who works his butt off, who knows how to take care of himself. He's going to be in tremendous shape, and we've talked about that. We know what Sean Davis, how highly Tomlin praised Sean Davis for being in great shape last year. So I think all those baseline things add up to not saying it's going to be an amazing season, but it's going to be a lot more than a little contributor.
And just to clarify, Lance Zierlein included him on a list of 5 early round draft picks he expected to be slow starters. Now, what's a slow starter?
I don't know what his criteria is.
This is a guy that he's going to be on some of these special teams units to start with and doing what they normally make these young linebackers do. But on the flip side, this guy, 10 snaps here, 12 snaps here. Right out of the chute, one would think and hope. By the midway point of the season, one would hope he's on the field, and not only on the field but making a difference as a pass rusher. Something I'm kind of looking at him. I just went through earlier today and went through all the Wisconsin game books, if you will, and pulled out the run stops that plays that qualified as run stops for T.J. Watt. So I'm slowly starting to match up the times on film with that. So it's not going to happen. Might not happen by the end of the week, but I'm trying to put together a series that'll help us look at the good things that T.J. Watt did against the run during the 2016 season. And what kind of stuff you got in store?
I have to think about what I'm going to write about tomorrow. I think I'm definitely going to, I just don't know when, but I'm going to bring back that one step to take series about, these younger guys where I want to see them really improve, for next year. And I might start with Johnny Maxey. I think I have something ready for him, but I'm going to go back through last year's tape and see what's in there. We'll see if we can learn anything more during these OTA sessions, and definitely have some film room stuff set up. But if anyone's listening and have an idea for anything film room or beyond related, obviously, hit me or Dave up on Twitter or on Depot, however you can reach us.
All right. And I think we're right at the hour mark here, so probably start time for us to wind it up. We'll, of course, see any nuggets that come out of Steelers OTAs. We posted on SteelersDepot.com. We'll be talking and wrapping everything up on Friday as well, too, either David Todd or Alex Kozora. In the meantime, I hope that you will follow me on Twitter, if not already doing so, at Steelers Depot. Follow David Todd at David M. Todd. Follow the show at Terrible Podcast. You can follow Alex Kozora at Alex_Kozora. You can email the show, theterriblepodcast@gmail.com. If you like what we do, you want to support the cause, go to SteelersDepot.com. Find that donate button, upper right navigational bar, if you'd like to put a few dollars in the coffee fund, if you will. And Alex, I appreciate you sitting in today. And we'll be back. One of the two of them will be back with me on Friday. And as always, thanks for listening to the Terrible Podcast with Dave and Dave.